And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. Let us go to Northern Ireland and to a specialist indeed in conflict resolution in Northern Ireland without a government today, prompted by the resignation of Martin McGuinness, first deputy of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Quentin, you are very welcome to the program.
Thank you, Adrian. Good morning to you all and all your listeners.
I know we have our own, as you know, this being day one of our new administration here, there is a lot of joy, a lot of celebration, a lot of anxiety and a lot of division with respect to the future administration, which is already underway. Ireland, Northern Ireland in particular, is having its own problem. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, you know, about your own career, your own job, and how did you become involved in the Northern Ireland peace process, and also the job, your career in conflict resolution?
Yes, I think it's an interesting passage, and it's largely because I was brought up with the Northern Ireland conflict going on around me. And some people were able to put their heads down and try to ignore it, but others became involved in various ways. And I had a passion for this little place. It's such a beautiful, historic, learned, literary place that my passion was for peace and progress. And at that time in the 90s, I was working in the nonprofit sector, helping citizens to get organized to do things in their local communities about the environment, about housing, about childcare, and of course about the conflict raging around them. And that's where we helped position the nonprofit sector and community-based organizations that they could do their good work, but if it wasn't done in a context that would help bring peace, that would help bring the two sides of unionism and nationalism, the Irish and the British governments, the European Union, were all actors in the conflict. And of course, the local people through their citizens' organizations could play a positive role if they so choose. So that's how I became to find myself in a position where I could influence change and be an outsider to the political process, but one which was able to project values of peace, progress, tolerance, recognition of different people working together in the same society.
You and your company, in working conflict resolution, you've worked actually in conflicts in Cyprus, including the 2004 referendum, Colombia, Kosovo, Israel, Palestine, Uganda, and you've lectured and written and consulted on your experiences throughout the world in four continents. Is there a particular reaction to you, to your accent, to your knowledge and your experience in growing up in Northern Ireland? Is there a suspicion, is it more difficult to work in your own backyard, so to speak?
Good question, because internationally we often are very attractive because Ireland has this amazing reputation worldwide and there's a fondness for it. It doesn't have an imperial and colonial past as the country of Ireland. It has a magnetism because of tourism, because of literature, because of poetry, because of art. And therefore, I think we do get further quicker. And in conflict resolution, it's about authenticity. if we can bring a truth into the Middle East or Colombia or Kosovo, that we also have been through conflict, people get very excited because they remember those pictures of Martin McGuinness, who indicated his resignation this week, and the late Ian Paisley Sr. They remember those pictures. And whereas 20, 30 years ago, they might have talked about, oh, bombs, bullets, it's dangerous. Now they talk about that image of the two leaders of the two sides who were never going to come together, actually coming together with joy, with happiness, with smiles on their faces. And that gives you a head start. I was working earlier this week in Turkey on the Syrian question, and the Syrians were saying, how did you do it? How did you bring your warring sides together? How did those two leaders, who we thought were always enemies, sit down around a cabinet table and make decisions? And that gives us a credibility. And sometimes I take them, and I've taken Martin McGuinness to Baghdad in Iraq, alongside Jeffrey Donaldson, for example, from the other side, from Paisley's DUP, and had them working together to show that peace is possible, to show that progress can be made, and that it's the power of change, the power of leadership to bring about change is possible. It's not just a theory or a spent force. We can change things.
Would it be fair to say that the highlight of conflict resolution in Northern Ireland was the world's exposure to that image and that projection of a arch enemy's, Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness actually getting together, dropping the hatchet, and working things out? That, I think, still is a very poignant image of the difference between, just a political cover-up and an actual getting together to on a single issue of peace and progress in Northern Ireland. Would that have been the impetus? Would that have been something that was the turnaround?
It was certainly a remarkable image. It reminded people of Mandela's release from prison. You remember that one, which then was followed by the democratic transition in South Africa, which no one thought was possible, given the numbers that 40 million white people and 4 million black people seemed to be overwhelming in one side. It was the other way around, 40 million black people and 4 million white people. And that was a beacon of hope. The one that wasn't quite so successful was Arafat and Rabin. Remember Clinton in his first presidency brought them together. And you see, you immediately say, yes, that photograph, Adrian, was 30 years ago. And yet you can summon it up in your mind's eye in an instant. And that shows the power of the photograph as a symbol of the immense hard work underneath it. And that's why we remember the Paisley McGuinness Chuckle Brothers photograph. But we sometimes forget the immense hard work that went to produce the circumstances where they could do that with the support of their sides, their voters, and with the prospect of delivering real change, which they did for 10 years. And that was in early 2007, so that was a decade ago. And now this week we were reflecting on that because a decade on, we've reached the end of that phase. And that was symbolized by Martin McGuinness tendering his resignation.
The circumstances of Martin McGuinness's retirement, and that's what it is. First of all, the stepping down, then the retirement, would again be interpreted perhaps in a divisive manner in which unionists might well say, okay, they're at it again. Martin McGuinness would have had to step down anyway because of his severe health issues. And so therefore, you know, killing two birds with the one stone here, he utilized that as the last hurrah, so to speak, to bring further change to Northern Ireland. Obviously, you're going to have people who will say that was too much of a coincidence that at a time when it looked like his health would require that he step down anyway, the timing is suspect.
No, I don't think so. I can see how those less closely involved might link the two, but actually the discipline of Sinn Féin as a political movement is such that their individuals always look to the central decision. And I think that it was unfortunate that his illness came at a time when the politics were proving to be very difficult. And I do believe that it was a coincidence, and he had to go through with those tough political statements and give a press conference in the state where people were shocked at his physical state. And I think that it was unfortunate that the two came together, because had the political debate and argument about his principled resignation taking place without the health issue, it might have focused minds more clearly. Now that the health issue has intruded, it means that the political debate will be conducted by those less directly involved, given that he, the post holder of Deputy First Minister, has had to pull out because of those health. But in a way, we should say, fair enough, we never know when that health scare will come. We never know when the doctor will say, look, you can keep working at this level and you risk dying earlier, or you can stop now, get off this treadmill, and maybe enjoy more time in your retirement and with your family and with your local community. So I think that's what's happened, and that will make it slightly more difficult for the resolution of the conflict represented by that resignation. And as you know, because of the jointness of our structures here, if either one of our First and Deputy First Ministers resign, the other one automatically loses office, and therefore the two stand together, but the two fall together, and that's why we're now moving into an election.
Well, in my role as devil's advocate, you put that one to bed fairly quickly, but let's get down to the nitty-gritty. What brought about the resignation of Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness? What was the that crucial that broke the camel's back?
The irony, Adrian, was that it was over a fairly mundane renewable heating scheme. In the push for more renewable energy, the Northern Ireland government had promoted a scheme to encourage the transfer from fossil fuel, from oil and gas heating, to renewable heating pellets and biomass and wood chips instead. And that was a scheme that went wildly wrong, and it was mishandled probably both by the officials who were doing the administration, but also by the politicians who were supervising it. We'll hear more of that from the public inquiry that was launched yesterday into that. But that was the tip of the iceberg, because underneath it was a looming problem of trust and respect between unionism and nationalism. And Sinn Féin, leading the nationalists in that government, felt that they weren't receiving the respect and the recognition. They weren't being treated as equals. And there were a number of other incidents. So there was the withdrawal of funding from an Irish language support scheme that they had backed. And that was seen as an added insult. But underneath it was that difficulty that 10 years since Paisley and McGuinness and that wonderful photograph that we were discussing, how do two opposing sides in a conflict with radically different end aspirations, a united Ireland for nationalists and republicans and a copper-fastened United Kingdom with the border, with the Republic strongly in place for unionism, how do you work together in the interests of the 2 million people who live here when you really want to have a different political structure altogether? And that tested their commitment to joint activity, to joint work, to joint decisions on health and education. And often in conflict societies, even these things like health and education have different characteristics. They're not secular, mundane matters. Education and the influence of the church and the influence of values, health and the influence, on women's health, on abortion, issues of equality in gay rights have characteristics that are not shared by both sides and are almost unsolvable because the positions can be so polar opposite. And that is what dragged us down in recent years. And that's what Sinn Féin were reflecting by causing Martin McGuinness to resign. They were saying, we cannot make joint decisions when we feel we are not being respected or trusted or given the right information. And therefore, we have to have a crisis in order to have serious discussions about how to resolve it and put it back together again in a new and better form.
Had the issue of the first Prime Minister Arlene Foster and the scandal of the, as it was known, Ask for Cash, had that not arisen, and had the anger across the community on both sides of the political divide, where 240 million pounds was squandered, had that not come to the fore, and the indignation about First Minister Arlene Foster refusing to step aside until the investigation was, had that not arisen, what would the scene be like today?
That's a very good observation, because we're now reflecting on that. Given that that was the straw that broke the camel's back, would we have been able to continue, and would another straw have come a week, a month, a year later, or would they have buckled down, made joint decisions, worked out what to do about roads and transport and economic development and investment and jobs? Of course, we'll never know, because the crisis did happen. But we're now trying to reflect on whether we can put it back together. And I was reflecting that with my Syrian friends this week, who were saying, we thought we would never talk to Bashar al-Assad, the leader of the Syrian regime, because he's been so awful. But right. We now, because of what you've been saying, think that maybe we do have to sit down with our enemy. Maybe we cannot just ask our friends to help us beat our enemy. We need to sit down with our enemy. And they said they were impressed at the way we had described our process here in Ireland. Because when I said our peace process had collapsed this week, they said, oh dear, how many were killed? And I said, well, there were nobody killed. And they said, oh, well, how did the crisis take place? And I said, there was a joint press conference. And they said, what? There was a joint press conference? And they said, well, what will happen now? And I said, well, we'll move to an election. And they were astonished that the conflict was now being conducted openly, without fisticuffs, without barrel bombs, without guns, and by a democratic process of moving to an election. So here you have two societies, and of course they're at the different ends of a spectrum. Sure. You have a horrible global civil war in Syria, and here in Ireland you have a developed Western European democracy, a developed Western economy, developed communication systems, and we are conducting our conflict with almost no violence. I think there were 7 people lost their lives last year in Northern Ireland because of political acts, only 7 people. And that is remarkable, and that's what we must keep. And that's what people are saying. Of course, we're frustrated that our politicians have had to pull out of the joint power sharing arrangements after 10 years. Of course, we're frustrated, but we desperately want them to work together. We want devolution from London and Dublin and Brussels. We want to work together for the betterment of our society and our future. And we look to other conflict societies and go, aren't we glad we're not like that anymore? And how can we draw the help of our friends? And that's where our friends across the pond in the USA can be of immense help now. Not to lose faith, not to lose the nerve of the support that you've given by sending your kids on exchanges, by sending your businesses to look at investment opportunities, by welcoming people from Northern Ireland over to study visits and discussions. And that's even more important, that we can live together jointly and easily whilst our aspirations as unionists or nationalists are held proudly. And that's reflected in our passports. We can have Irish or British passports or both, so that citizenship is recognised and preserved. So the future is a positive one. We're in a less than ideal situation at the moment, but it's not total breakdown. And with goodwill and the support of our friends around the world, I'm sure we can find ways out of it.
There will be a new election. It's called a snap election. Why snap election? Is that just a term?
It is. We had got into the cycle of 5-year assembly elections in Northern Ireland, and this one is brought forward because of the resignation of Martin McGuinness. So I suppose in that sense it's snap as opposed to pre-planned from 2016 to 2021. The next one had been expected.
Now, how is the election and how is that going to affect, or how is Brexit, which seems to be a total can of worms, how is that going to affect the election in Northern Ireland? Are there those who I won't say could care less, but are there those who, in addition to having the peace and relative prosperity which has come with the peace process, are there those who could care less about that and much more concerned about Brexit and where Northern Ireland stands when Brexit is actually effectuated, which what it looks like will be sooner rather than later?
It is certainly a problem because in our scheduled Northern Ireland Assembly election of May 2016 last year, they were working very well together, and Arlene Foster and Martin McGuinness were settling down well, and then Brexit happened. And it didn't hold the ship below the ground because Arlene Foster and the DUP had been supporters of Brexit. Remember, they wanted the UK to come out. And Martin McGuinness and nationalism and most others, including the UUP, the softer unionists, had been in favour of remaining in the EU. So Brexit did drive a hammer between the two sides that made it difficult for Northern Ireland to represent its interests together, because one was saying, this is good, let's look at the world and build trade arrangements in the world, and the other was saying, but this island is important for trade. Did you know 60% of our milk produced in Northern Ireland is processed in the Republic? So 60% of our milk moves across the border, and therefore if you have a hard border and that milk is delayed, even by, say, by 5 minutes per truck, and there's 1,000 trucks a day moving across the border with milk. So you've got 5,000 minutes of delay as paperwork or checking takes place. That's devastating because the milk will turn sour. And
yes.
The creameries will lose money, and the Irish creameries will lose trade and will potentially go out of business. So there are real difficulties at that very practical level. So Brexit is a huge practical and emotional problem for Ireland, north and south. The southern economy trades hugely, as you can imagine, with Britain, not just with the north, as I described on agriculture and other issues, but with Britain across the water. 60-70% of its export go to Britain. So how will that affect the Irish economy, and how will Ireland hold up its head within the Europe of 27 when it has the island in between, which isn't in the trading bloc, and therefore it has to fly its goods or go by ferry to France. So huge practical issues, and therefore having a political problem in the north, now it's not back to violence, but it's still a political standoff, doesn't help solve those questions of a free and open border to move people, not just tourists, which clearly is a benefit to the island economy, but those cattle and products and goods and services back and forwards across the island. 30,000 workers cross the border every day because they work in the other jurisdiction. They don't want to be delayed at long queues to have their cars checked and their passports checked and their paperwork and their right to work in the other jurisdiction checked. So those are big issues that need to be dealt with, and we hope that they don't become leftovers or left off the agenda while we work on the conflict between unionists and nationalists and resolving the DUP Sinn Féin questions, because these Brexit questions are urgent. As you say, if Theresa May, the UK Prime Minister, starts the process in March, and meanwhile we're having an election and then possibly a talks process to put the Humpty back together again, and not paying due attention to Brexit. So we really need to focus clearly on these different moving parts, or else we could be the victims of unintended consequences.
You had mentioned earlier about a role for America, for Irish America in particular. How do you see that as A, being helpful, when in fact most of like America and in general looks at Northern Ireland and says, well, there is the peace, it's a peace process, call it what you want, but there is a peaceful Northern Ireland while the rest of the world seems to be falling apart. And how do you get the attention of not only Americans, but let's say the Irish, the island of Ireland diaspora, to say, wait a minute, so something just, somebody kicked the block out from under the car here, and there is a collapse. What are we supposed to do? What exactly, on a practical level, can we do? And you've mentioned the investment in Northern Ireland, the tourism, all of the good things. But what can America do between now and March 2nd that will change anything or that will be helpful?
I can remember you asked me that question 25 years ago on your program, Adrian, when I was a young student in the City University of New York, and President Clinton, the first Clinton, had just come into office in 1992,
right.
And you asked me, well, what can Clinton do? He's from Arkansas. He's shown very little interest in Ireland so far. And then he made this remarkable contribution, and he made it economically by sending, I think it was George Mitchell and
right.
Jim Lyons and others as economic envoys. He made it politically by helping in the talks process by sending George Mitchell to chair the talks process that produced the Good Friday Agreement. He helped it culturally with his recognition of Irish culture and promotion of that. He helped it socially with the movement of people and students back and forwards with visas. He helped it in tourism terms by his visits to Northern Ireland and then his help to bring American tourists and American businesses to invest. So there are lots of things that can be done, however unexpected. And now we're asking people not to forget us. Of course we've made huge progress. Of course we're not Syria or Palestine or Sri Lanka or Burma, Myanmar, at different stages of our conflicts. And those people who have a fondness for Ireland, whether by history and their own families or whether by interest and by reading and by visits, can play a part. It can be really supportive to know that people are thinking of us and to soften some of those hard edges. I know in New York 25 years ago, there were people who were bringing different perspectives. It wasn't just, you know, friends of the IRA and NORAD, or were you on the other side? It was lots of shades of grey, and people who were hosting seminars and dinner discussions were really contributing to us rethinking our conflict, that we didn't have to win. It wasn't about having a united Ireland totally and unionists being forced back to Britain, or a hard border of unionists and nationalists having to make choices. We could accommodate something different. And that's where we are now. We need your space, your support, and your thoughtful backing to underpin the process that we've made so much of in the last 20 years since the Good Friday Agreement and the subsequent referendum on both sides of the island's borders.
I can only tell you that the goodwill from our side to for Northern Ireland and for a peace which at best looks like it could be subject to a setback, the goodwill, I think, is positive from here. The election itself will be enough of a distraction from now until the beginning of March. We would hope that sanity and goodwill will prevail amongst the political parties in Northern Ireland, and that this will not create a further divide, you know, bearing in mind that Brexit, one way or the other, is going to affect not only Northern Ireland, but the island of Ireland. And again, if we keep it in a positive light, we still have to recognize that politics will indeed is alive and well, and there'll be a lot of jockeying for a position in this upcoming election. Let us hope that it will have a good ending. Can you just give us, finally, I want to ask you, Quentin Oliver, about the atmosphere leading up to the election, and what do you see happening on the ground, and how do you see that either becoming a plus or a minus as we head towards the election?
Well, I'm looking out over a fantastically sunny Belfast on this cold January morning, and that in itself makes me feel positive. I have seen canvassers move up and down my street giving out leaflets, knocking doors and seeking support for their positions. We have a proportional representation system here, as your listeners will know, so we can vote 1, 2, 3 down the ballot paper, and that allows us to cross over. So we don't just have to say we are a unionist or we are a nationalist. There are other parties who are neither, and we can vote across the piece, so we can vote for a nationalist and then a unionist or vice versa. We can vote for the Green Party, the Alliance Party, lots of others. So there's lots of choice, It's very democratic. It's very proportionate. And those parties who inject the right level of policy, how do we solve the renewable heat scheme black hole? So there's an economic fiscal question there. But more importantly, how do we get our elected representatives to work jointly, to work together on roads and economic development and transport? And that's the bigger prize in order to put the executive, our cabinet table back together so that those pressing issues, and we've discussed the Brexit ones, and there's also pressing issues of economic deprivation in many areas, pressing issues of environmental protection, that they can be addressed and dealt with. Now, that's possible with the voice of the people. And the people are angry about what they've seen. They're disappointed at the lack of progress between unionism and nationalism. They're angry at the mistakes and some incompetence and some malice, whether it's corruption and whether there'll be criminal charges on the heating scheme, we don't yet know. But they will be voting for the future, hopefully not about the past and about the conflict, but they'll be voting for the future. How can our representatives build a political structure that gives voice to all views, but also gives competent, rational, problem-solving decision-making? And that's what governments should be doing.
Yeah.
That's what is so different between Syria and its conflict, between your new arrangements in the States after the inauguration of President Trump. What will that mean? Of course, people will be anxious, concerned, apprehensive, but they have a voice. We have electoral democracy to elect our leaders, but we have participative democracy to allow people to express their views and opinions and to urge change of directions. And that's where you get a really lively citizens' democracy that can help move us forward, I'm certain.
Thank you for joining us, Quinton Oliver. You have a website, and one which I would like to direct our listeners to. Can you give us that, please?
Sure. It's Stratagem, INT for international, stratagemint.com. And it will tell you about our conflict resolution work around the world and our work in supporting the peace process here in Northern Ireland.
I thank you. And indeed, for those of us who have, noticed that Northern Ireland kind of went off the boil with respect to all the great stuff that has been happening in Northern Ireland and the success of the peace process, probably the new upheaval, if that's what we can call it, in Northern Ireland on the political front, has been well overshadowed by our own election here. I thank you for straightening us out in that and removing the doom and gloom that we hear and see and read about here. Thank you, Quinton Oliver, and friends listening to Irish Radio Network USA. Thank you.